This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be able to visit with one of the best and smartest people that I know. We're visiting today with partner at McGuire Woods, Tim Fry. And Tim's really just going to talk through us today the four or five healthcare trends that he's watching the most closely. Tim, let me tee it up. I know you used to work for CMS. Now you've been a partner at the law firm for a long time. Tell us a little bit about the four or five healthcare issues that you're watching the most closely currently.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. And let me give you a quick summary at the outset, and then we can dive in a little bit more. I work primarily with physician practices and investors in the physician practice space. So, of course, my comments come out of that. So a couple of the key areas we're seeing, and then we can dive in further. One, we're seeing investors a lot more interested in value-based care models and building theses and investment opportunities around that. Two, we're seeing kind of the fallout of the No Surprises Act and a lot of the regulatory churn there as people try to get their arms around it. Three, we're seeing more physician groups, especially investor-backed physician groups, working with hospital systems and not just for ASC joint ventures. And then quite frankly, fourth one I'll just throw on the table. The president said earlier this week, you know, the COVID pandemic is over. And so we have a lot of clients starting to unpack what that means, some of the flexibilities that the federal government have given. They're starting to ask the questions, if those come away, how do we have to change our operations back? So kind of from that investor and physician background, working on regulatory matters for our clients, those are a couple of the key things I'm seeing, Scott, and would love to visit on each of those with you and your audience.
Thank you. And you talked about President Biden saying the pandemic's over, and the CDC released guidance today saying, you know, we're done with, no longer required to have masks in healthcare facilities. And talk a little bit about, on the flip side, there's concern that with the pandemic, quote unquote, being over, this may make it harder to bill for telehealth in certain ways, may make it harder to access certain public emergency funds. And people are really still trying to unpack what that all means, aren't they? They're trying to figure out what it all means to say the pandemic's over and whether that really has the effect of saying the public emergency is over or not. Any insight there, Tim?
I think that's right, Scott. You know, HHS to date has said that before the end of the public health emergency, because they had given so many flexibilities, they are going to give providers notice and the wider industry notice in advance of when the public health emergency ends. Usually it's slated to end. There's always a date. And then every 3 months, the secretary has to renew it. And they've sort of said, we're going to give 60, 90 days before that next renewal and say, nope, we're not going to renew it again. They haven't announced that yet, but it's very likely coming in the near future. I wouldn't be surprised if HHS is sort of waiting to see if we have a new COVID wave here in the fall, like last year. And if they do, then they'll obviously extend it. But if we don't have that same massive upswell of a wave, and instead it's kind of like an annual flu season, maybe then it does expire. And then if it does expire, I think, Scott, you already hit on the key things that people are thinking about. How important has telehealth become to our practice? Are our physicians kind of relying on that either for their patients or really for their own quality of life? If they are, what are our commercial insurers going to do? Are they going to continue to reimburse it? Medicare has already started to add some additional telehealth procedures that will be included in the fee schedule or anticipated to be in the permanent fee schedule after the COVID emergency. But what about other services that you've been doing now for a couple of years? Folks are looking at that, starting to figure it out. The other part, and I think you hit it, relief funding. We are now seeing an upswell in kind of the investigations around, especially the uninsurance program, the SBA loans. The New York Times had a big expose this week on it and some of the abuses and fraud that took place. Well, clearly the government is going to be investigating provider relief fund payments billions of dollars went out the door on, you know, one day without any advance notice. How was that money used? Do they think it's been used appropriately? And Scott, we visited before about kind of how the Provider Relief Fund program was built up over time after the money went out the door. There's going to be a lot of investigations and discussions. And so people are trying to get their arms around everything they did. They're doing some of their mandatory reporting. And then, you know, some of our clients are being thoughtful and going even further, which is we fulfilled the terms and conditions. Now let's make sure we paper our files as well. Let's make sure we do our own internal audits. Let's make sure we have our house in order so that as the public health emergency comes to an end, when it comes to an end, we feel comfortable that we're going to be able to defend everything we did during this period.
Thank you. You'd also mentioned the No Surprises Act. And I don't know if people sort of expected this. I know some certainly did. But hospital-based specialties, particularly anesthesia and emergency departments to an extent too, have gotten really hurt bad by the No Surprises Act, because all of a sudden, instead of billing out of network or even if they were billing out of network before, they're now, the payers are emboldened to pay a lot less on those out-of-network claims. There's an arbitration process in many places, but at the end of the day, it's leading to lower payments. This is leading to paying for hospital-based specialists, which most health systems will say, well, that's okay. Who cares what there's paying for them? But what's happening with those hospital-based specialists, even though they're independent, they're basically saying to hospitals, give us big subsidies or we got to go elsewhere or we're not going to work here. And so you've got this situation where anesthesia has become a huge pain point for hospitals and health systems in a lot of places. ER doctors, the same thing because of the No Surprises Act. Is there more in the No Surprises Act that you're watching and following, or is that part of what you're seeing and part of the challenges?
Everything you just said is exactly what we're seeing. We're also seeing in some geographic regions, and this was especially the case when CMS's initial rules came out with DOL and others, Department of Labor and others, around the No Surprises Act, that they basically were going to put the locality rate, the qualifying payment in a locality, as the most important factor to what out-of-network payment should look like. We've seen in some geographic regions, or it feels like in some geographic regions, that payers are, even for in-network providers, reducing their rates because then they can get that average rate for discussions even lower. So we're hearing some of that. The other piece that folks outside of the hospital-based specialties should be aware of, and we're starting to see more and more people realize they need to be, is the No Surprises Act has a host of other requirements on providers. So providers are required to notify patients that there are protections around balanced billing, even if they're not going to be kind of a hospital-based specialist. And for uninsured self-pay patients, providers have requirements around giving good faith estimates so that patients will know what they have to pay in advance for every service. And so there's this kind of whole bureaucracy building up, whereas I think most people knew, as you quite correctly put, Scott, that around the hospital-based specialists, surgery center specialists, that there would have to be requirements. The regulations, the statute actually have gone beyond that and put additional burdens on physicians and other providers to make sure patients in certain categories are hearing what they're going to have to pay and then not charging more than what they estimated ahead of time.
Thank you. You had also mentioned or alluded to, and not in this conversation, but a different discussion we had about this Biogen settlement this morning, or that came out the last couple of days, $900 million settlement on kickback issues and so forth. Any application or anything that health systems should learn from that, or others should be thinking about with that?
Yeah, no, thank you, Scott. So the Department of Justice announced a $900 million settlement with Biogen earlier this summer. Biogen actually settled with a whistleblower in a False Claims Act case that the government had not intervened in. The government wasn't involved in the kind of civil suit staying involved. Instead, the whistleblower continued to pursue it and led to a $900 million settlement. And the settlement was based on Biogen's speaker programs, programs designed to kind of introduce the drugs that they were marketing to physicians. And there are all kinds of allegations around this. But I do think the hospital community can learn from this, not just a pharmaceutical company and a speaker program. The government is very interested right now in these speaker programs, in continuing education programs, and whether those are leading to improper incentives. So it's been big in the pharmaceutical community, and a lot of the drug manufacturers have adopted all kinds of care protocols and processes to avoid these types of litigation. But earlier this summer, the Office of Inspector General put out an advisory opinion for ophthalmologists and optometrist programs, effectively disfavoring and not approving a number of ways to give kind of continuing education to optometrists at a discount, worried that that would incentivize referrals to ophthalmologists. And I think what you're seeing is the government getting, you know, kind of shining a light on more than just the traditional kickbacks or payments of remuneration, but looking at things like education, opportunities to interface with someone at a fancy dinner. Are those leading to kind of incentives to send your patients to certain providers and not others? And so I think that's something that...
Well, absolutely. Just to piggyback on what you're saying, I mean, absolutely, the view of the pharmaceutical companies, it's so broadly discussed in this movie, Dope Sick, about the opioid settlements, the amount of money that was being provided to pain management physicians, you know, in different ways, and speaking fees, consulting fees, and other things. And everybody sort of really knew that they were really driven towards getting lots of prescriptions of the opioid-based drugs. And so OxyContin and so forth and those kinds of things. And you look at the same thing here with Biogen. That concept was, were these speaker fees, consulting fees, other things really basing it in to prescribe MS drugs? And that's what the internal whistleblower thought was happening. And similarly, with ophthalmologists, a lot of ophthalmologists have built optometry networks. They get a lot of their business from optometrists. So different ways that they're trying to get money or reward the optometrist and make sure those aren't related to referrals to the ophthalmologist. And that was in the hospital sector when there were more independent physicians. There was so much of this kind of thing, trying to find ways to wine and dine in different ways, the big admitting specialties. Yes, the hospitals also employ more physicians, maybe there's a little bit less of that, but something still to keep an eye on, I take it.
That seems exactly right, Scott, and in something where, you know, whether it's independents or working with, you know, specialists that are working with, you know, PE sponsors or whatever, is making sure you're being consistent on monitoring the value you're providing, what are you doing with golf outings, meals, keeping track of all of that, and really, you know, kind of thinking through a robust program, because it is an area where clearly the government, these settlements, there's a real push to kind of push back on the items you just mentioned, Scott.
And from my perspective, Tim, golf is always angelic, and there's no reason they should go after golf outings, but everything else sounds right. No, I'm just kidding. Tim?
It depends on what course, Scott. It depends on the course and your handicap.
Exactly. Where you're as bad a golfer as I am, any kind of time there's free golf seems like a good idea. Tim, I want to thank you for joining us again on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Always great to speak to you again. Tim Fry, a magnificent partner, McGuire Woods and the Healthcare Group, just tremendous. Thank you so much, Tim, for sharing some of your thoughts today with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Really appreciate the time.